Athletes love pushing their limits, but intense training can cause serious imbalances. This is exactly what happened to me. My name is Christopher Kelly. When I first entered the world of competitive mountain biking, I became plagued by numerous chronic health issues. So I changed my diet, and I identified my key imbalances with advanced biomedical testing. Before long, I was feeling and competing better than ever. Now, I'm helping other athletes do the same. Welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. This week, my very special guest is Amber O'Hearn. Amber is a data scientist by profession with a background in maths, computer science, linguistics, and psychology. She has been studying and experimenting with ketogenic diets since 1997, and more recently writing and speaking about her findings. I first became aware of Amber's work through the Ancestral Health Symposium, that is AHS for short, and her AHS 16 review on the evolutionary appropriateness and benefit of weaning babies onto a meat-based, high-fat, low-carb diet was included as testimony defending Tim Noakes in his recent trial. Amber has been eating a carnivorous diet for over 8 years. Well, Amber, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted to have you. It's been far too long. You should have been on the podcast by now, probably several years ago, but here we are. This is great. We're recording in person at the Saguaro Hotel in Scottsdale, Arizona. We've just been attending the Physicians for Ancestral Health Winter Retreat, which has been fantastic. A group of like-minded physicians giving presentations on what they've been learning over the last year. And then some non-physicians like myself and Amber giving talks too. Not me though. I'm not really a talk person. I'm more of a podcast person. But it's been great. Wouldn't you agree? It's like lovely here in Scottsdale, Arizona, and we're really hoping to get more people attending. I've just got back from a fantastic mountain bike ride. The riding here is great, and we found a shop that rented me a bike, and it was all super smooth and really great. And the old town here in Scottsdale is great too. How's your trip been, Amber?
It's beautiful. It's peaceful here, very congenial. And I love the group also because the atmosphere is very intimate and the talks are usually much more, instead of trying to present what we already know, present what we're thinking about, what we're learning about now. So it feels very cutting edge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always thought that about these conferences, that the best bit was outside of the talks, right? I could watch the talks on YouTube afterwards. What I couldn't do was walk up to the presenter and chat to them about stuff, anything you like. And of course, that is the main emphasis of this retreat, which I really enjoy. But you can't do away with the talks completely, right? Because that's what ignites the conversation. So
exactly.
Well, tell me, I'm sure you're bored of telling this, but I mean, it's just so incredible. I'm going to force you to do it again. Like, you know what's coming, don't you? So tell us about how you got into it. So you are a computer programmer in a previous life. I mean, once a computer programmer, almost a computer programmer. You said that you used to be a computer programmer when you began your talk, but let's face it, do you still write code on a daily, weekly, monthly basis?
I don't know. It varies from time to time.
Okay.
You know, I never wanted to be a programmer, but it gets in your blood. I wanted to be a mathematician. I went to school for math when I first went to university, and I had to take a programming course as part of my math degree, of all things. And then I realized that it was like math on steroids.
Right.
It's like anything that you could get your slow brain to do, as long as you had an orderly way of organizing what you were going to do, you could ask a computer to do it for you. And the sky is really the limit once you have that ability.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible. So how did a computer programmer come to discover the low carbohydrate diet? Because that is where you started. You're doing something slightly different, and we'll get into that, but it all began with a low carbohydrate diet, right?
Very reluctantly. I was brought up vegetarian, and so all of my biases fit into this plant-based narrative that continues to go on today. And when I was in university, I started having weight issues, which I really disliked, and so, of course, my first thought was that I should just return to a more plant-based diet, double down on it. When that didn't work and exercise didn't work, I actually tried veganism, and that didn't help me either. I had seen a little bit about low carb diets, but I immediately dismissed them because they were just so contrary to everything that I already believed that I didn't, that just didn't even seem reasonable. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until actually I had gone to study Russia in St. Petersburg, and I was a vegan at the time. And
how did that go down? So are there many vegans in Russia?
It was non-existent. And also I was on a very limited budget. And if I went to a store and I was going to live as a vegan, there just wasn't the variety. You couldn't go and buy soy milk or something like that. So it was going to be pasta.
Right.
And
rice.
And then moreover, I was staying with some people and I didn't want to reject their food. And so I thought, okay, look, I'm just going to eat what they're eating here. And when I go home, I can return to my diet because I've got other priorities right now. Mm-hmm. But then when I got home, I had actually lost some weight. And while...
Oh, so can you describe the diet that you're eating in Russia?
It was just an omnivorous diet. I was eating bread even.
Right.
But it included meat.
And that was the first time. So you didn't have any... I mean, that's pretty unusual for someone determined enough to be a vegan. And, you know, you're at someone's house and they say, would you like a steak? Usually those people say no, right?
Well, I wasn't vegan for the staunch... moralistic
okay.
or ethical reasons. I was just vegan because I thought it might solve my weight problem.
Okay.
And so I gave up on that and I was thinking of it very temporarily. I'll eat these foods and I liked them and I'll just return to my weight loss problem when I get home. Mm-hmm. But so when I got home, I had lost some weight and I could have very easily dismissed it and come up with a million reasons why I had lost weight that didn't have anything to do with diet.
Which should have been very reasonable when you're on holiday, right?
Sure. And it might not have been the reason that I lost weight, frankly, but the fact of it just made me suddenly rethink. And so I thought, well, maybe there's something wrong with my understanding and maybe I should look at it in a different way. And I thought back to the time when I'd heard of a low-carb diet. And the timing was set up really well because when I went looking for a book in the bookstore, which is how you did it back then, Michael and Mary Dan Eads had just released Protein Power, so it was on the front of the shelves.
Oh, really?
And I picked that up, and the rest is history for
okay.
me.
So why not something else? Surely, I've not been to a Barnes & Noble on the street for a long time, but... Isn't there a million different diet books when you walk into... Was it just pure chance? Did like Mike Eads do a really good job on the front cover of Protein Power and you thought, you know what, I quite fancy living on steak?
Well, I think it's because I really was looking for something different because I had tried all these
right.
other things.
It's got to be... It can't be slightly different from what... It needs to be something drastically different.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was a low carbohydrate diet. How low carb... Can you describe what the new diet was like after the... veganism.
What it was like for me experientially or what,
yeah,
the, diet
what the diet
was like.
Was like. Tell me about both. What was the composition of the diet like?
Well, I haven't looked for a long time, but I think you were supposed to figure out your protein requirements and make sure you're hitting those based on some simple calculations about your frame.
Right.
And your gender and height and age. But then mostly you were cutting back your carbohydrates and there may have been a minimum of 20 or 30 grams. So it
wow.
was all about figuring out what different foods were composed of. So that was an educational piece for me. So everything that went into my body, I read the label and I looked up in tables and found out.
You'd never done that before?
No.
look how far you've come.
And so, well, I don't do that now either.
Well, I know, but like you still have an intimate understanding of like what's going in.
Yeah.
What year was Protein Power?
1997.
Wow. I was only just starting university then and I can't even imagine what my dad probably, well, a lot of cereal, pasta, bread and all that kind of stuff. I had no idea. It took me another 20 years to like figure this stuff out. That's it. The reason I'm sort of really interested to know like how on paper we have quite a lot in common. We're both programmers. You're definitely more theoretical and mathematics based than I ever was. But why is it that like it took me so long and suddenly, you know, what with you, it's so different where, you know, you figure this stuff out so quickly, relatively.
I don't know. I mean, I think it comes down to need.
Yeah.
You get to a point of...
Yeah, just my need wasn't strong enough at that time. And eventually I had this crisis.
Right. Crisis opportunity, right?
Yeah. And what happened then? You eat enough protein, keep the carbs really low. And what happened is suddenly the weight all melted off. How much did you have to lose?
Absolutely. About 30 pounds. I lost it easily.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so what you thought at this point, oh, this is great. I found my true diet for the rest of my life. This is all I have to do. It's sustainable. I can do it. No problem.
Yeah, I was really happy about it. And that diet at the time, I included a lot of plants, a lot of salads. I can remember my first Christmas after I had discovered that, I modified all the foods that weren't going to be low carbohydrates. So I didn't touch the potatoes, but I made sure we had all the traditional things in my family, like the Brussels sprouts, and I ate the turkey, and I made some kind of a low carb trifle dessert. Mm-hmm. I was excited and enthusiastic because I felt like I had really learned something that most people that I knew of didn't understand about how you can actually affect your physiology through diet. And so it was very exciting, and it gave me such pleasure to have solved that problem for myself.
Mm-hmm. And when does Zuku come onto the scene? So Zuku is your ex-husband, and I feel bad for, I don't know whether that, I mean, you're still good friends right now,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I thought so.
He's
so
one
I feel
of my
okay
favorite
about,
people.
That's great. So I feel okay about bringing that up. So when did Zuku, Zuku is an extraordinarily interesting person, as I've only really discovered more recently, but I've been aware of your ketotic.org site for a very long time now. You've been doing that for a while. So when did Zuku come to, were you already married?
No, we met in 1998, so okay. Not long after that. He tells a story in which we had met and we were very interested in each other. And then he found out about my low carb diet and he said, oh gosh, I was so disappointed that this woman that I met that I thought was so interesting and intelligent, it turns out she believes in this total quack weirdo thing. Now I won't be able to date her. But I was able to persuade him that there was some real intelligent thought behind that and real science. And so then he was pretty quickly on board with it. He didn't take it on himself until later after we were living together. We ate low carb most of the time.
So he didn't have any particular problems that he was trying to fix. He was just, I mean, super helpful when the whole family eats the same thing. And I really feel bad for anyone that's trying to implement a diet that's different from what the other people they live with are eating right now. Because that is, for me, like very challenging.
Yeah, there's two levels of problems, I think. Well, there's making different meals for everyone is difficult. It can be difficult if you have problems with willpower, for example, and if it's just hard for you to have those things in the house, in a moment of weakness, you eat them and then your diet's out the window. But then what's really a problem is something that I also never experienced, fortunately, is outright sabotage or just disapproval where your spouse is saying every day, you know, you shouldn't be eating that. I've heard stories of
people...
They
may not even need to say anything, right? It's just that kind of that look.
Or the
spouse that's rolling their eyes, you know?
Yeah.
It's the worst.
Or saying, you know, you're overweight, so you shouldn't be eating that bacon or whatever it is, you know?
Tell us a bit about Zuku's background, because he, like I said, he's a very interesting character.
Zuko and I met at a financial cryptography conference. And so he's been interested in the cryptographic potential of financial transactions for a really long time. He was working with David Chaum back in the days of, I can't remember the name of the company where they were doing micropayments. It's something he's been thinking about for a really long time. In the early days when we were together for fun, we would work out protocols trying to solve micropayment problems. And so, for example, how would you make sure that if someone had a coin, they wouldn't double spend it? Mm. And how would you make these kinds of mathematical guarantees over networks? It's just something that has captured both of our interests for a really long time, but obviously something that he was definitely passionate about to a great degree.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about Zcash? I think since I've got you here,
sure.
I feel bad for making you like do his elevator pitch, but Zcash is like a fascinating
technology,
isn't it?
I'm happy to. Yeah. So when Bitcoin came along, we were all blown out of the water by the elegance of the way that it solved this problem that, as I said, we'd been thinking about as a hobby for so long, and many people had, you know, people much more dedicated to that as a discipline than I ever was, we're thinking about these problems. So when Bitcoin came out, we were fascinated by it. And one of the things, though, that we noticed or that Zuko noticed was that the anonymity wasn't there. Well, so it's anonymous, but what happens is that every coin has a history. Mm-hmm. So you could trace back where a coin has been and you can discriminate based on that. And because of histories, you can even kind of de-anonymize it. If you know enough about a person and what they do, you may be able to match patterns. Mm-hmm. Whereas what you really want in a currency is the ability for one unit to be completely fungible, is the word that they use in finance. So $1 is just as good as any other dollar, and you mm-hmm. can't tell one from another.
Right.
Like cash. It has no history, and one is completely exchangeable for another. And so that's the vision that he had that helped him to create Zcash. And he hired many brilliant cryptographers to make sure that that happened in a mathematically safe way. And they called it Zcash. Originally, it was called Zero Coin because I don't remember exactly what the zero was for. Oh, how can I have forgotten? It's zero knowledge proofs, which... So a zero knowledge proof, if I can just try to explain this in a non-technical way, you know something and you want to prove to someone else that you know it without telling them what it is.
Right.
So think of this challenge, like how are you going to prove to somebody that you know something without going through all the steps that reveals what it is?
Right.
But there are ways to do this cryptographically. And so the way the currency works is based on that.
The reason I think this is important is that I think at some point these technologies are going to be used for supporting user paid content. So let's suppose I believe that a low carbohydrate diet is superior for weight loss and blood levels of cholesterol have no effect on cardiovascular disease. And somebody at Stripe or Authorize.net or maybe someone at Visa or MasterCard completely disagrees with what I'm saying. And they can just turn me off, right? Switch off your merchant account. You can't take payments anymore. Delete you from the web. So I'm wondering whether at some point, you know, these technologies are going to be super important to have freedom of speech in user-supported content. But it's really all speculation at the moment and perhaps a little bit of scaremongering. But I mean, it does worry me when you see people starting to be deleted from Wikipedia and, you know, people closing their Patreon account because somebody disagreed. So the person I'm thinking of actually closed their account just in protest of the lack of freedom of speech. But I know, I suppose it's all speculation on my part this time.
It is, but those are exactly the kinds of appropriately paranoid ideas that the currency was designed to mm-hmm. combat.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about how you got started on ketotic.org, because that was where I first became aware of your work. And one of the things that really struck me about this blog, so I was kind of, as a software engineer, it's kind of interesting. When you do a computer science degree, you don't actually do science. Have you noticed that? It's like, there's no, never did I use the scientific method to, you know, change what you think about a hypothesis. And I was very unfamiliar with PubMed and any of these archives of papers. And so I was used to that blogosphere level of information. You know, that's where I was used to getting information. I probably didn't even know that PubMed existed in 2012, you know. And then I came across ketotic.org, and suddenly they had all these references at the end of the document. And not only, it wasn't just a list of citations, you know, where you had got your sources, but you had these things that I think you call like a double, what do you call
end-to-end
it?
End-to-end citations.
End-to-end citations. So you'd actually pulled out the exact part of the paper that you had referenced as well as the paper itself. So you didn't have to, I'd say the worst case scenario actually that we've seen a lot of recently from someone I won't mention is they'll write an article like saying something bad about the ketogenic diet, and then they'll dump a bunch of references at the end, and there's no citations in the body of the text. It's just literally just a list of things that they've accessed. And then it's kind of down to you to try and figure out where in the text these citations are used, and then where in the paper they were even reading to form it. Sorry, so this is an incredibly leading...
No, that's exactly, that's exactly why that happened. It was born out of a particular frustration.
So you
also
had that problem.
You know, it was repeated, but there was one particular article that really set me off in such frustration where the person had made a really interesting but controversial, in my mind, claim. And I thought, where did they get this? And like you said, they didn't even have, you know, a match to a paper at the end. They just had something like 40 references at the end of the article. And there was a long article with many things about it. And I looked in all 40 of those papers and I could not find a single thing
right.
that would lead me to believe that claim. And I was so frustrated. And I thought, I'm never doing that to my readers.
Right. Yeah. And then you start to wonder, and I wonder what you thought, whether Sarah Ballantyne, sorry, did I just drop that name? Had actually, whether she wanted to deliberately obfuscate the reference, or whether it was just kind of careless and wasn't paying the appropriate amount of time and attention to that task.
I honestly think that it can be both. And the reason that I say that is because there are things that I, first of all, things that I felt I'd read multiple times and that I was really sure of. And I have said, well, I better put a reference in there because someone who's not familiar with this material isn't going to know. And I'll be damned if I could not find a single reference to where I got this idea. And I thought, am I making this up? And sometimes it seems like, well, actually, maybe I am. I could not substantiate it. And so that's been very humbling. But then the other thing is that sometimes, and I haven't been quite as deep as I probably should be if I were to be perfectionist about it. But sometimes I'll find a paper that has the claim that I want. Like you said, with the end-to-end citation, I don't just give the paper, but I will excerpt the exact passage that I think the paper, where the paper is showing me that particular claim. And so sometimes the paper will say it, but they're not really supporting it. They're just repeating it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have to follow their citation. And sometimes I've followed a chain of citations and it doesn't really have an end. It's just this
Chinese
thing that's
whispers.
Been repeated over and over.
Yeah.
So I think that even if you give complete benefit of the doubt, even the most well-meaning people can be misled by what they're reading.
Mm-hmm. And did you come up with this scheme, or is this something that's used in mathematics or somewhere
else? I did. I've never seen it anywhere else.
Wow. And so what was your goal with ketotic.org? Did you have a specific agenda, or were you just trying to share what you'd learned? What was it about in the beginning?
Well, it was about sharing what we'd learned, but we did have a vision. Back at the time, you know, we had too much going on to make this happen, but what we had thought that site was going to evolve into would be a site that went through all the different kinds of diseases and conditions, or even non-conditions, that ketogenic diet has promised to improve.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it was called, the site's name is actually the Ketogenic Diet for Health. And what we wanted to do was go through several different kinds of diseases that a ketogenic diet might prove useful for, as well as things that aren't diseases. So just optimizing, like, could it be the case that a ketogenic diet actually improves your cognition compared to a non-ketogenic diet? And then we also wanted to go through different myths that people were bringing forward to discount or argue against a ketogenic diet. And so that was what we had wanted the site to do. It ended up being way too large an undertaking for us, so we just have bits and pieces. But what it mostly became was finding what people were talking about in the blogosphere that seemed to us to be unsubstantiated, and drill down and find out if there was scientific truth behind it. So, for example, there was one piece that I did early on about gluconeogenesis.
I was going to say, your state just turns into chocolate cake as the moment you put it into your stomach, doesn't it?
Right. So, I mean, that's what people were saying. They were saying, you know, but it was really vague. They'd say, excess protein turns into glucose.
Yeah,
well, what does that even mean? So what's excess protein?
Right.
I mean, when you're eating it, does your body suddenly say, oh, you've had your 60 grams, the rest of this is glucose?
Right.
And if so, how does it know?
Right.
And so I really wanted to find out what was behind that. And it turns out not very much. I mean, some people were actually making this argument based on the ratio of ketogenic to gluconeogenic amino acids in it, and just saying, oh, well, the ones that are ketogenic are going to turn into ketones. And
this
ones
is purely
that
theoretical. You say, oh, alanine is gluconeogenic, therefore, if you eat too much alanine.
Right, right, right. And so I found out that just having the substrate there was not enough for the liver to go ahead and make it into glucose. And so I went into this kind of deep dive about when gluconeogenesis is actually happening. And it seemed to me that it was much more of a demand-driven process. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote about that, and I chose it because it was a presumed truth, and I didn't think that there was anything to it.
Where do you think it came from? Do you think it was just people looking at biochemistry textbooks and coming up with ideas that were all theoretical and then maybe some of that was taken out of context. And like you said, like the Chinese whispers in the references, right? Like before you know it, it's like a golden rule of ketogenic diets, thou shalt not have too much protein.
Well, at a certain level, protein is going to throw you out of ketosis. So there is some truth to it.
Okay.
But I surmise, and it's just conjecture, that the reason why this started to be talked about is because on a ketogenic diet, it's funny, if you look at studies with people on a high-carb diet, if you give them protein, it has no effect on blood sugar. But if you're on a ketogenic diet, or if you're diabetic and you have protein, it makes your blood sugar rise. And so people are saying, where is this blood sugar coming from? And their answer was, oh, it's, you know, protein can be turned into sugar, so it must be the protein being turned into sugar. And I don't think that is what's happening in the blood sugar rise case at all. What's happening is, because first of all, the sugar that you make out of protein isn't going directly into your cells. It's going into glycogen stores. So the rise in blood sugar that you'll see when you eat protein is coming from glycogenolysis. And what's happening is that it's indirect.
Right.
So when you eat some protein, your insulin rises and your glucagon also rises.
Right.
And they rise in tandem if you're on a low-carb diet. And it doesn't actually change. And that insulin to glucagon ratio doesn't change, I should say. And that's the signal that's telling you whether to stay in ketosis or not. It's the insulin to glucagon ratio, not necessarily the sugar in your blood.
Right.
Whereas if you are on a high-carb diet and you already have, or if you already have hyperglycemia and you eat protein, your response hormonally is going to be completely different. Your insulin is going to go way up compared to your glucagon, and that will send a completely different signal. And that's why the blood sugar doesn't actually rise. So if the insulin and the glucagon are going up, you're getting a call for glucose. If you start using all that glucose, eventually, the more your blood sugar goes up in response to protein, the more you're going to be in that other situation where protein's going to affect you. So it's more of a gradual thing that happens that builds up.
And so where did you end up with all this? You know, you do the, sometimes I think you do a deep dive and you look at all the biochemistry and you, you think you know something. And then suddenly you, like, I have these like moments where I think, you know, I don't know anything. I really, you know, like, when you get proven wrong like that and you have to admit it, you're like, Jesus, we don't know anything. I'm not even going to measure blood glucose or ketones or anything. I'm just going to eat real food and hope for the best, you know? And we've just heard Josh talk about that, like the game level intervention, right? Let's just stop messing around with the details.
Oh, yeah. Well, when you're looking at biochemistry and forming these theories, the pitfalls outnumber the right way. Richard Feynman, who I like quite a bit, Richard Feynman the other, he describes it as playing a biochemical pathway pool where you've got this pathway and it hits this other pathway and then it hits this other pathway and you're trying to get the ball in the hole. But in reality, you never know which of these pathways is going to be activated or is going to become predominant. So, yeah, I mean, every time I write an article, I go through the same process. It doesn't upset me as much as it used to, but I would come up with this idea and I would say, oh, wow, I bet it's actually like this. And I'd start doing research and I'd start putting together this article. And about three quarters of the way through, I'd go, oh my God, it doesn't work like this at all. This idea is totally crackpot. I've got nothing. I'm going to throw this away. It's garbage. And then eventually I'll persuade myself back and I'll say, oh, no, no, actually, this is a good idea. I'll write it up. But having seen that process where one new piece of information can completely discredit the whole idea, I developed a little bit more, I don't know, relaxedness about being wrong. What I try to do, in the best way of putting it, I guess, what I'm doing when I write these things down is trying to figure out and remember for myself, almost like documenting code, why do I have the idea that I have? Where did it come from? What were all the steps that I used to get there? Because if one of these steps is wrong, I want to know how to recover and where to go next. Whereas if I didn't write it down, I didn't go through that documentation of all that reasoning, then when some new idea comes out, I might not even realize that it impacts all these beliefs that I have. Or if the final conclusion is proven wrong, then I want to say, well, that means that somewhere in this reasoning, something was broken and what happened there. So most of what I'm hoping to do is just capture the reasoning process and try to learn from that with the knowledge that you know, half of what we think we know is wrong and we don't know which half.
Is there anything that you thought was true 5 years ago that you think is wrong now?
Oh, probably. I've been doing a lot of rethinking around salt. It's true that the recommendations for salt are probably wrong in that we shouldn't have to limit them. They certainly don't have the effect on blood pressure that the media likes to tell us that it does. So yes, there is a scientifically, like statistically significant effect on blood pressure, but the effect isn't significant in the sense of it's minute. Mm-hmm. If you really want to make a change in your blood pressure, a low-carb diet can bring down a high blood pressure in a way that reducing salt never could. But then there was this whole hoopla about extra salt maybe being beneficial, and it could be. A lot of people who were on ketogenic diets have told me that as soon as they realized they could and should be taking in a lot more salt, these problems of fatigue or cramps that they had been struggling with for years suddenly went away. But then I decided that what might be happening with the salt is that there's a salt-potassium balance and there's also a water factor about how much salt you need. And so if you've been told to drink lots and lots and lots of water all the time, you might be flushing out electrolytes and need to replace them. Or if you're using potassium because you've been told that you need to be taking that as an electrolyte, then maybe you need more sodium to balance it. And so that's one thing that I've been thinking about, and I've been actually flipping back and forth on about my thoughts for quite a while. But one thing that I think I'm beginning to change my mind about right now in a sort of twisted, ironic way is about the needs for DHA, the fatty acid DHA, because it's known that we can't convert much of the linolenic acid into DHA. And so I've been arguing, because I think about the brain a lot and infants need DHA to grow their brains, about the importance of animal foods, especially in our evolution. I've been saying we needed to get this DHA in order to build our brain. And that's, I still think that's true. However, it turns out that we may be able to convert more than I initially thought we could, ironically, when we're on a very low-carb diet. So I say ironically because it doesn't affect the evolutionary argument. It just affects it for different reasons. So what I would like to be able to say to make this work out, in my mind at least, is that maybe we can get enough from conversion, but only if we were eating high meat in the first place.
Right. And so where does linoleic acid show up?
So that would be the plant form of the omega-3.
Right.
So for example, vegetarians are often told to make sure they're eating a lot of flaxseed oil, which is a high omega-3 source.
Right.
But it's very unlikely to do them any good because they can't convert it in their bodies
to
the DHA.
In the UK,
we
use that for treating cricket bats.
For treating what?
Cricket bats.
Oh, yes, yes. I'm sure it's good for the wood.
It's basically furniture polish. But if you go to Trader Joe's, you'll see it on the outside of pretty much every cereal box, right?
Right. So I don't actually think that we were eating a bunch of flaxseed oil back at that time. But I do think that maybe the animal form of the omega-3 that is just in subcutaneous fat, maybe we had a better rate of conversion for that into DHA than we now give ourselves credit for.
I mean, you can get that from fish as well, right? And eating
the
brain of another animal, right? Say you weren't anywhere near the ocean or a lake and you didn't have a ready supply of fish, then couldn't you just eat the brain of another animal?
You could, yes. And I should say that if you were determined to be vegan, there is a source that's derived from algae that is actually DHA itself. It's not the omega-3. So that can be done if you really need to.
If you don't mind having some heavy metals that have been sequestered by this algae.
Everything in the environment's got problems now.
I know.
Yet fish is not even exempt.
So tell us about, I hope you don't mind talking about this, the bipolar. So you're not eating that same low carbohydrate diet that you described earlier, and you've since changed your diet quite a bit. So do you mind talking about the bipolar?
I don't mind. So I used to tell my story as a weight loss story, and weight loss was certainly a big motivating factor for all the things that I've done. And it was also, you know, it was changed dramatically by the various things that I've done. But now when I look back at the history of it, every time that I had trouble with my weight, I was also having some kind of psychiatric problem. So the first time I had a weight problem was my first year in university. I think I gained all that 30 pounds maybe in 1 or 1.5 semesters. Oh, really? It was really very quick and disturbing. And it was also the first time I had a depressive episode that was very disruptive, and I was diagnosed then. I was put on Prozac then, and I was on Prozac for over a decade. That's a whole other part of the story. So then when I went on a low-carb diet, it did help me with my mood, but it didn't completely solve the depression. The depression didn't go away. It kept coming back, and it was called treatment-resistant major depressive disorder was my diagnosis, because nothing that I did really solved it. And then later, it was after my second child was born, I was trying to get the order of things correct. So I was still suffering from depression. I saw a new doctor who said, well, you know, the Prozac hasn't been working, so why don't we try something different?
What, and you've been doing it for 10 years and it hasn't been working?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say. Maybe it was working. Maybe it was better than...
No counterfactual. There's no duplicate Amber walking around you can compare to.
Exactly, exactly. So we tried, first of all, Effexor, and then I think we added on Wellbutrin as an adjunct a little bit later. We might have started them both at the same time. And what happened then was, I didn't know it at the time, but I started having my first hypomanic episodes. I didn't know what hypomania was.
We,
I didn't know what
mania
was. Hypo, of course, means little, and so it's a little mania. Mm-hmm. It's not a psychotic episode. So the technical difference between a hypomania episode and a mania episode is psychosis. I had no psychosis. But I had this, what would lead to a mania in a person who has full-blown bipolar disorder type 1. And so it's characterized, well, first of all, by feelings of euphoria, which to me was fantastic. I hadn't felt that in as long as I could remember. And more kind of rapid and pressured speech, excitement, and more flirtatious sexual kind of behavior. All of these things that become, when you go into, if you go into a psychotic episode, then suddenly you start having delusions of grandeur, and you make these plans, and you spend all your money, and you think that you're going to solve everything by this idea that you have, but then you crash and burn. So it felt really great, and I didn't recognize it as being pathological at all. But then it would always be followed by a depressive crash. And it wasn't until this was mentioned to a doctor a couple of years later, because I had had it a few times, that he said, you know, that sounds like bipolar to me. I'm going to recommend you see this specialist. And then I was indeed diagnosed as having bipolar type 2. And bipolar type 2 specifically means that you don't have psychotic manias.
Okay. And so this is after your kids are born, you're working as a programmer, or you just...
No, I wasn't working. I was a stay-at-home mom.
Okay.
For a very long time. But it was after I had had 2 of my 3 children.
And how can you describe what, you know, an average day would look like when you were... I always like wonder whether these words are misleading.
What do you do all day?
No, I don't mean that. I mean, what does mania really look like? I sometimes wonder whether... You know, it's like manic compared to the opposite. Like, I always wonder how many people are just like, it's like coffee, right? Like, people think that coffee gives them, or caffeine gives them a boost. It doesn't really. It just returns you to baseline. And I wonder, I'd always wondered whether bipolar was like that, whereas you'd meet someone on one day and they would seem completely normal, and that was manic. And then what you didn't see was like the depressive episode where they, you know, maybe felt like they couldn't even get up out of bed or something. So can you describe?
Yeah, well, that's how I felt about it at first. And the idea that these hypomanias were pathological was actually really offensive to me, because I thought, I feel good for the first time, you know, and now
how
you're
dare
saying,
you try and take this from me.
Yeah. And in fact, if you talk to a lot of people who have bipolar disorder, staying in a perpetual state of hypomania is kind of the holy grail.
Right.
Because it does.
People
does
pay
feel
a lot
great.
Of money for nootropics for that, right?
And it's funny that you mentioned coffee, because when I was looking back later, I decided that, you know, it's not just my own theory, but medically antidepressants can induce mania. Mm-hmm. And so I think the combination of antidepressants that I was taking as well as caffeine are what made this start to happen.
Okay, interesting.
It precipitated the disease and we're making it worse. So it is a little bit like being on coffee. And especially the comparison doesn't end when, you know, if you've had a little bit too much coffee and you start to feel a bit edgy.
Yeah, it's jittery. It's not a good feeling.
No. And this is actually how what started to develop for me is something called mixed states. So if it had stayed in a pure depression alternating with hypomania, I might have liked that a lot better. But what happens with mixed states is you start getting a sort of offset, a lack of synchronization between mood and energy. So you could have high energy, but you're irritated.
Mm.
And so then you start feeling these things like irritability, anxiety. So the ups are no longer euphoria. They actually, you're up, but you feel bad.
Right.
And then also in terms of synchronization and cycling, I started developing what they call rapid cycling. And so my mood would change. You know, someone with bipolar disorder type 1 may be depressed in the depressive phase for months, or it could be a year, and then be in the manic phase could take months to develop before it ends up in hospitalization. But I was having, within a single day, very severe variations
wow.
in mood. So after I got this diagnosis of bipolar, when I got over my initial reluctance about it, I felt actually very happy, because I thought, well, of course the Prozac didn't help me. It was a drug for the wrong condition.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe now when I start trying these bipolar medications, this will actually help me. And I was still of the mindset that a psychiatric disorder was a matter of they have this imbalance, chemical mm-hmm. imbalance in the brain idea. And I really abhor that idea now, because to me, it sounds just like calories in, calories
right.
out.
I think you'll find it's a bit more complicated than that.
So, you know, if they just say, oh, you've got, so they can put it one of two ways. They can say, you have too much unhappiness and too little unhappiness. But in the chemical sense, they'd say, oh, you have too much noradrenaline and too little serotonin or something
right.
like that, right? So, and they say, okay, we'll just give you this drug and it will increase your serotonin levels, and then that will deal with the imbalance. But what they don't realize is that you're unbalanced because your body's homeostatically at a set point that is the wrong set point. And so if you try to just intervene by adding something that changes the level of serotonin, then eventually your body's just going to adjust to that, because it has its own idea of where it's supposed
right,
to be.
Right, right.
And so you have to get to something that's further upstream that's mm-hmm. working on where that set point is coming from.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there's no attempt to understand the underlying process that's leading to the problem in the first place. That's what, I mean, that for me is tinkering without knowing. We've just been listening to Josh talk about, well, these tools for reducing environmental mismatch and how to categorize them. But yeah, it's tinkering at the source code level in Josh's nomenclature. And
yeah
it's,
and
it's
I really
bad
liked
news,
the
right?
way he put that, because yeah, it's like messing with assembly code when you really need to be looking at the pattern or something.
Right.
You know, right. You want a much higher level of abstraction sometimes to solve a problem. And if all you do is intervene at some very low level, well, in some cases it can be really helpful. Like Josh said, if it's a genetic, you know, if there's some transcription problem and you're correcting it, that could make a world of difference.
Mm-hmm.
But if all you're doing is causing a whole bunch of responses at a different level, then
right.
you're not getting anywhere.
Right. And actually what's happened to Tommy recently is a good example as well, right? Like I watched the viper stick its freaking teeth in my ankle and I know there's an anti-venom for this venom, right? Like that's a kind of source code level intervention, but it's more than justified and it's a simple fix and a single cause and a yes. single cure and it works just great. But when it's a complex system with many interacting factors, yeah, good luck with that source code level intervention. So I'm wondering about what this is like for your kids. I mean, kids don't have that type of control over their, you know, they're just their state of mind like an adult can, right? They don't really have willpower. They don't really have the ability to like rein in their thoughts and stuff. So what was it like for your kids trying to interact with an adult that was just all over the map?
I shudder to think.
They don't talk about it now. How old were they?
I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder before I had any children.
Okay.
And I was diagnosed, I think my second child would have been 3 or 4.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think it was excruciatingly difficult for the whole family. It was a nightmare for all of us. And, you know, I was doing the best that I could.
Of course, yeah.
I think that there were a lot of good
things. It's kind of ridiculous to think
that
anything else was possible, you know? Like, even to say that is like, of course, like, what else would you be doing? Like,
and, you know, I did a lot of good things. I think I made a pretty good home in some ways. So I was a stay-at-home mom. I did a lot of extra education for my children. I taught them how to read and how to, you know, do prime factorization before they were in kindergarten. And, you know, we were really geeky that way and it was fun and I cooked. But I also was very malcontented because I wanted to be in academia and I was unable to juggle all the simultaneous responsibilities. And I think that's not even someone without bipolar disorder would have probably the same issues. It's very hard to, parenting is a full-time job. Graduate school is a full-time job. Both of those jobs are things that you could work all day and never be done.
Right, of course.
So I was struggling with that and with the different things in my life that were competing for my attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then the drugs, the bipolar drugs that I was so excited to start taking, they were worse than the disease. One of them came, like none of them helped. I tried 4 or 5 and they each came with their own side effects that was terrible. One of them gave me word access problems. I'm a very verbal person and I stumble over words and I forget about, you know, I have word recall issues too. But this was just very basic words I could not think of. And I started feeling like I was suffering cognitive decline, that I was losing my mind. And then another one gave me something called akathisia, which means you're feeling very uncomfortable. You can't see me, but I'm wiggling my back because I'd be sitting in a chair and I'd feel like I just can't get my back into the right comfortable position. Mm. There was no comfortable position. It drove me crazy. And then another one, there was also another one with a physical symptom. It's called brain zaps. You would get this feeling periodically throughout the day, like there was a shock going down the back of your head. And, you know, that can't be good.
Wow.
That, you know, is only minimally disruptive, but it's certainly disconcerting. But the worst one for me was one that actually caused anxiety. It caused such anxiety that when I got out of bed, I felt like either I or one of my children was going to die during the course of normal activities at any point. Like my child would be out playing and everything seemed like an imminent danger, to the point where I thought, I just have to accept the fact that I'm going to lose my child today.
Oh, wow.
Like it was insane, completely irrational.
And did you act on any of these thoughts and feelings?
I knew that they were irrational.
Oh, interesting. So you still had this kind of, I don't know where these words and images in my head are coming from, but I can see that.
But I still
not,
believed them.
You believed them, but you didn't. There's something
but I didn't
going
believe
on
them.
There.
You know.
Yeah, you didn't believe them
maybe
enough to act on them.
Maybe it begs the question of what belief is.
And you weren't doing any, was there any psychotherapy or any other kind of talk therapy that was helpful or anything you'd found that could help you deal with these thoughts and feelings?
You know, I went to a lot of different therapists over the many, many years and many of them were helpful. I learned a lot of skills. I learned a lot of cognitive behavioral techniques mm-hmm. and really cool really cool behavioral modification stuff, but none of it was really strong enough, even before these bipolar meds, none of it was strong enough to pull me out of the hole of deep depression. Mm-hmm. So if I were feeling just a little bit depressed, I could maybe say, oh, that's all or nothing thinking and you can change your thought, or, oh, you know that when you go outside for a walk, it makes you feel better, even if the idea of it right now. And so I could use these ideas, but as soon as it got to a certain threshold, that was it. I'd be lying in my bed, you know, feeling like it would be better if I were dead. And there no cognitive therapy that I knew of could touch that. But I'm really glad in retrospect that I went through all of that training, because once my depression was under control, then these techniques have really made vast improvements in my life as a kind of normal functioning person.
Yeah, like the little ups and downs that, that everybody deals with, you've now got these ninja skills where you can like see it, head it off and do something useful.
Yeah.
You mentioned going for a walk there. Is there anything else practical that you found to be really helpful?
Behaviorally? Well, I think social activity is always better for me than I think it's going to be.
Right.
I'm an introvert by nature, and if there's something fun going on, I just have a really high activation level. It takes a lot before it'll get me out.
Yeah, I definitely recognize
that. When I could be sitting home reading or something.
Yeah, if someone invites you out for dinner and you think that's the worst idea I've ever heard, I'd rather like do anything apart from go out to dinner with you. And then you do it.
It'll take hours of my time.
Yeah. And then on your way home, you're like, that was great. Why don't I do that more often? You know, but the next time it comes around, it's exactly the same again, right? Like, oh, this is a terrible idea. I'd much rather stay at home.
Exactly. Exactly.
So what finally works then? It obviously wasn't any of the meds. It wasn't Prozac deficiency that you were suffering from. It was something else you figured out.
And so then, you know, the motivation goes back to the weight loss. All this time, I'm getting sicker and sicker. I'm still on a low carb diet and I'm getting fatter and fatter. So I know that I was over 195 pounds, but I stopped looking at the scale and I'm not sure how much over. And it was so frustrating because I knew that what I was doing, because I'd been doing all this studying of ketogenic diets, it seemed to me that it was the best known intervention for weight. But at the same time, I felt like I was a terrible spokesperson for it. Here I am saying, try this for health and weight loss, but don't notice that I actually don't have control of my weight.
That's a very slippery area, though, I always think, because you've no idea when you see someone speaking about controlling their weight with a low carbohydrate or any other type of diet for that matter, you've no idea where they started.
And by the way, the opposite is true too, right?
Like you see some, you know, advocate of some diet posing on Instagram with no shirt on. Like you've no idea what they were like. I want to see a picture of that person when they were 17, like where they'd never even thought about what a diet should or shouldn't be. And they were probably ripped then too, right? It's like such a...
Yeah, so we all know people who can eat whatever they want and they, at least for now, they look awesome. And you're absolutely right. I think that I am struggling against many genetic factors, for example, that predispose me to obesity. And also, whenever I would go off a low carb diet, because, you know, if it's not doing for you what you're hoping for it to do, then why impose these restrictions on yourself? Mm-hmm. So many times I thought, well, F it, right? I don't know if I'm allowed to swear.
Yeah, no, I definitely swear on the podcast.
So I would say, you know, fuck it, because it's not helping me.
Right.
So I'm going to go ahead and eat that ice cream or whatever it is.
Right.
But, you know, even just bread and potatoes are things that I really liked. But if I went off a low carb diet for any period, I would immediately begin gaining substantially. And so I know the low carb diet was helping me. It just wasn't getting me to where I wanted to be. And so because of that, I was always on the lookout for something else. I felt like there was some missing piece. And because there are people selling all kinds of missing pieces, I tried many, many things. I had this whole apothecary of, you know, just, you know, maybe I need more carnitine or creatine, or maybe I need a liver cleanse.
So when you said that, I thought you were going down this route. So the reason I said, oh, really? Because that's kind of what I think of Nourish, Balance, Thrive as being, is this very holistic approach to all problems related to health and performance. You know, we're not just coming at it from the dietary perspective. So in the beginning, 2013, you just said to me, I thought I could fix the world with a paleo diet. And then I realized, oh, damn it, like there's this sleep thing. And then, you know, a year later, like, oh no, social isolation, that's a problem I can't even solve, right? And so over the years, it's been the revealing of all these different dimensions. And I'm starting to wonder whether there are any more dimensions left to discover. Maybe not, perhaps there is. But
well,
that's what
I think there are dimensions. And I think that the basis for many of the things that I tried were the real, true missing piece for some people. Like some people actually did not be able to methylate their B vitamins,
right.
That made all the difference for them. But I started trying everything and I had this air of desperation. I was looking for the magic bullet that would solve the broken thing about me.
Right, right. So we see that all the time. It's like, mm-hmm. we call it silver bullet thinking. It's like thinking it's just going to be one thing. Which is it? Is it reishi? Or is it shiitake mushroom that's going to solve all my problems? Right? Like that's just, I'm guessing it's going to be probably neither.
Right, right. So I was looking for ideas and it was all very focused on this weight loss piece. And at the end of 2008, I stumbled upon a forum called Zeroing In on Health, ZIOH. It doesn't exist anymore, but there's a Facebook successor of it that exists now with the same people. And they were all with a similar background to me. They had been on a low-carb diet and it didn't get them all the way to where they wanted to be. And when they went on this plant-free diet, suddenly they were able to lose weight again. And to boot, many of them were reporting all these other health improvements. And so I very pragmatically thought, okay, I'm going to try that. And it's going to hopefully help me to lose weight. And then when I get to the weight that I want to be, I was very much thinking of it as a diet in that kind of traditional sense.
Right.
When I get to where I'm going to be, I'm going to go back to my regular eating.
Yeah,
but to me, regular eating was low carb.
Right.
And I felt like the low carb diet, yes, I had gained weight, but it had taken many, many years. And maybe I could use it as a kind of tune up now and then. That's where I was imagining it was going to go. And even still, the whole idea of giving up plants, not because I was worried about the health effects because it was very temporary, but just for the variety of it and the role that it played in my life, it was a very intimidating idea to give up plants, mm-hmm. even for a short period. But I thought about it. I actually planned it for 3 weeks before I decided to do it. And then that plan was a short term. I'm going to do this for 3 weeks. And then I'm going to reassess and see if it helped me. And it was just astounding how much it helped me. I started losing a pound every day or two in the first weeks that I did
this.
Which
is really... What was that? Was that just water? What do you think that was?
It must have been fat.
Yeah, I'm sure some of it was. But I wonder whether, like, that rapid, I wonder whether some of it's water, like you're carrying a bunch
of... Well, I was already keto adapted.
Yeah.
But maybe. I mean, maybe.
Yeah.
Definitely fat contains water, or adipose tissue does.
A little bit, yeah. We've looked at this because we thought it might be the reason that people don't get thirsty when they're fat.
Well, yeah, it's like 50%. You have this metabolic water. It's way more than is stored in glycogen.
Tommy looked at it and in the end he thought, I doubt that's enough water to really make any difference. So it's something we've noticed as endurance athletes is, you know, I can go, I mean, I did it this afternoon. We went for a 3-hour bike ride with Clay and I drank half a bottle. So probably only 250 milliliters of water. We're in the desert and it was 20 degrees Celsius. I just wasn't thirsty. I was fine.
Yeah. Well,
and
think about
why
like
is that?
Camels,
Yeah. And then if I had been pounding down goose that whole time, I would have drunk like a 4-liter Camelback of.
Right. And that comes back to the speculation I was making earlier about salt, where I think, especially if you're athletic, you drink water because that's what you're supposed to do. And if you're drinking a lot of water, that can really upset your salt balance. Lots of people that I know in the zero-carb carnivore community are endurance runners, and many of them have said, in particular Charles Washington, who was the founder of that ZIOH group, he's a runner, and he used to always say, I don't drink while I run. All these other people drink, and I don't drink. So I think there's definitely something to that. I'm very interested, actually, in dry fasting because of the metabolic water aspect of it, where if you think about it, well, let's look at it this way. There are migratory birds who use ketosis. They do a fructose to build up fat stores while they're on land, and then they use ketosis while they're in flight, and they don't drink. Mm-hmm. And they're getting their water as metabolic water, and that's what they do. There are experiments in animals where if you put them on a fast with water and without water, the ones that are not drinking water burn way more fat. And I think that it's your body says, we need more water, we'll burn more fat. And so that could really disrupt or at least change the way that your body is using fat if you pay attention to the water balance.
Mm-hmm. It's got to be something to do with the osmolality of what you're consuming as well, right? Like it's you've just consumed a bunch of really dehydrated stuff and then you get super thirsty just to bring it up to a level where it can be absorbed, I think is some of it. It happens so quickly as well. You see, I've done this in a bike race. You're like, you know what? Screw it. I'm having a gel. Like the caffeine and sugar is going to be great. And you have it and all it does is make you thirsty.
Yeah.
Instantly, yeah. You're really, really thirsty. And then yeah. It's a pain in the bum because you haven't got any water. All right. So, okay. So I got totally off track there. So tell us about, so the weight loss return, which was great. But before that, we were talking about your neurological stuff. So what changed there? Did you notice something right away?
I did notice that I was feeling happy, but at first I didn't really notice.
It's just a weight loss, right? Of course you're going to be happy.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. Here I am thrilled. But then I started realizing not only am I happy about this, but I feel good in a way that I haven't felt for a really long time. And just feel consistently good and not irritable. But one thing about bipolar is that it teaches you not to trust your mind. So, you know, We were talking about how did I respond to these feelings of anxiety when I was on, that drug was Abilify. What's such a smarmy name. aripiprazole, it's called generically. So I was quite used to being flooded with emotions and thoughts that I knew full well if I waited, I would have a different thought about it. And so there's this disconnect between your brain and your brain now. You stop trusting yourself. It's the worst thing about it, really. And the medical community actually encourages that for good reason, because one of the symptoms of bipolar disorder is to believe that you don't have it.
Mm.
Which can be very frustrating for the people in your family.
Yeah.
Because when you're upset about something, there's always an object that upset goes onto, and it can be very legitimate. So just because I have bipolar disorder doesn't mean that this situation doesn't suck.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
And so if someone tries to tell you, that's your bipolar disorder talking, it's very insulting and off-putting because, you know, this is a legitimate issue in my
right.
life. So your medical support and your family is supposed to be encouraging in you to not believe your feelings and not believe your thoughts. And it's the worst position to be in, really. That's absolutely the worst thing about it. So here I was feeling really good. But I knew that this could be just a phase or just part of, you know, a swing, a mood swing or something. But I did mention it to Zuko eventually, many days, like 2 weeks in. I'd probably been feeling like that for most of the time. And
so how long ago is this now?
This is 2009.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So 10 years ago.
Right.
Right about now.
Wow. Congratulations. 10
Thank
years.
You.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
It's much longer ago than I thought, you know. For some reason, because I've been hearing you talk about the carnivore thing so much recently, I'm like, oh, well, this is like something you started 15 minutes ago, but clearly not.
Well, it took me years to even start coming out.
You don't
want
to jinx it.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't just that, but first of all, I didn't want to write about it because I was worried about compromising my employability. I thought someone's going to look me up and they're going to say, oh, this person has bipolar. There's no way I'm hiring her.
Okay.
Right? We're not going to look at that resume anymore.
Right.
And I wouldn't blame them. So I was reluctant to talk about it for that reason. And I was also reluctant to talk about it because, ironically, because it's such an anecdote, like, I don't know what really happened.
No.
And I wouldn't want to be embarrassed later to discover that I had fooled myself so thoroughly.
Right.
So it did take me a long time to come around to talking about it. And when I first started speaking and writing, that's part of why I have these two separate blogs. One of them that's so science focused. I did not want anything remotely about this personal experience I had to taint that.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I was feeling really great and I broached it in conversation to Zuko. And he stopped and looked at me very seriously and he said, I haven't known how to bring this up with you, but your mood has been better and more stable than it's been in the entire length of time that I've known you.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And that was already, we were just a couple weeks in. And so I knew that something profound was happening. So I decided, I had made this plan, this 3-week plan, ingeniously to end on my birthday so that I could have a low carb cake in celebration. And by the time that birthday came, I didn't want cake. Yeah. It was like, no way, I'm on a roll.
Yeah.
I'm not stopping this for anything.
There's no cake that could make me feel this good.
Yeah. Sadly, I did end up stopping, and so I don't count my carnivore birthday really now, even though this is when I discovered it, because within a couple weeks after my birthday passed, I found out I was pregnant again. And I was going to stay carnivore. I had looked into the whole ketogenic during pregnancy thing enough that I wasn't at all afraid of that aspect of it. And I thought what's good for the mother is good for the baby. And I had every intention to continue, but two problems intervened. One was, well, three problems. Depends how you count. One was extreme carbohydrate cravings. And I think that that just comes from during that first trimester, your body wants to get fat. And so insulin is just jacked up. And so this whole time that I'd been doing, as soon as within days of starting the meat only diet, all cravings for carbohydrates went completely away. But then suddenly, one day, I woke up and I was thinking about carbohydrates. And I was thinking about them all day. And then like the next day, I was just like sitting on the couch trying not to think about carbohydrates.
Good luck with that.
So
or you know, anything else. I could,
at a certain point, it was just like, boom, I am gone. And I went down to the local diner and I bought 3 entrees and I ate them all. And they were not low carb. So there's that aspect. And I did get, after that first trimester, that eased off and I was able to get back to low carb and I even had
What happened to your mood when you reintroduced those carbs? What happened to your mood?
You know, it's hard to disentangle that from the hormones of pregnancy.
All sorts of stuff going on.
I wouldn't describe it as a very stable time. I wasn't suicidally depressed, but I was moody for sure.
Okay.
For sure.
Okay.
The second component of it is that I come from a line of people with hyperemesis gravidarum, which is a pretty rare condition, but there's severe vomiting during pregnancy and not just the first trimester.
It goes on. Yeah. Julie's done a podcast with a woman that had that condition. Yeah. And the ketogenic diet, I think, has been shown to be quite helpful for it, isn't it?
Well, you know, it may well have been because I was ketogenic at least before all of my pregnancies. And in none of my pregnancies was I remotely as sick as my sister was, as my mother was, as my mother's mother and my mother's sister. And so all of the female people in my family, ancestors before me that I know of, had severe, my mother was hospitalized.
Wow.
And I was sick, but I wasn't that sick.
Mm-hmm.
But it did affect my ability to eat. I couldn't look at a piece of steak. I couldn't buy it. And I was just basically ate whatever I could get down.
Right.
So those two components really ruined that whole plan. So it wasn't until after my third child was born that I got back on this carnivorous diet, but I never lost sight of it. It was, I know I'm doing that the minute that I feel up to it.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever look at any of those papers? You know, Tommy's talked about this a little bit and he's actually done some experimental research that the milk contains medium chain triglycerides that are synthesized from carbohydrates in the epithelial tissue in the breast. And I believe that Tommy has done some experiments where he looked at rats and the pups were less ketogenic when the mother was deprived of carbohydrates. And so, a lot of it is conjecture, I think. But there is some stuff in the literature about it. I mean, it seemed old, like the papers I saw, and I wondered whether you'd thought about that at all. If you haven't, then we'll just move on. But just in case you have thought,
I feel like I have looked at those papers and wasn't persuaded, but I don't remember any of the details, so now I'm going to have to dive back into
yeah.
it.
Yeah, I'm kind of out of my depth there. It's definitely Tommy that's kind of dug that stuff up and has done some experimental research. Well, that's fantastic. So what exactly does your carnivore diet look like? So what happens? So, you know, keto has been around a long time, and then suddenly, you know, so in 2016, we did the Keto Summit. And when Jeremy Hendon said to me, we should do a Keto Summit, the time is now. And he'd been Atkins decades before, right? Mm-hmm. And he was like, now is the time for keto. And I thought, you're trying to tell me that no one's done a Keto Summit? And no, they hadn't done it. Everyone wanted to be a part of it, and it was a great success. And no one could really explain to me, why was it that this diet that had been around for quite a long, well, very long time, right? Since the 1920s for epilepsy, refractory epilepsy. Like, why was it in 2014 or something that it suddenly started to take off exponentially? And now the same thing has happened with carnivore. It's not, I mean, you've been doing it for 10 years. And then suddenly all I see all over the internet, is it just that I'm trapped in a filter bubble and Facebook noticed I interacted with a post that was something to do with carnivore, and now it's all I see everywhere I go. It follows me around like a bad smell.
Well, I don't know if you're in a bubble. I'm certainly in a bubble. I can't get away from it. So for me, it's been really extraordinary. And, you know, you could point to all these factors and say, well, it was this person or it was this post or it was this site that made it more popular. But, you know, maybe it was just the time had come, the world was ready for it. I don't know. I don't know. But we are in a position now that last year I was doing a lot of ketogenic conferences. I was going to them. I was speaking at several. And suddenly, and it wasn't the case the year before, but suddenly everyone wanted to know about the carnivore diet. So there was one, I gave a talk at Low Carb Breckenridge. It wasn't about the carnivore diet at all. And all the questions to me were about the carnivore diet. Now, that's understandable because I'm known for that. But I wasn't the only one. Eric Westerman was getting questions about the carnivore diet. Georgia Ede was getting questions about the carnivore diet. That's all anybody wanted to know about, right, from my perspective, suddenly. And so by the end of that summer circuit, I said, you know what, we need a carnivore conference. And so I put one together.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know.
Yeah. So it's happening in Boulder. It's on March 7th, and it's the day before Low Carb Denver.
Okay.
I scheduled it so that if people were coming to Low Carb Denver, they could add on a day and get that if they were interested.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So I'll get this podcast out before that happens. So if you're listening to this, then presumably I can link in the show notes. Or do you even know, is there a domain where people can go and register?
Yes, it's carnivorycon.com.
I love the way that Josh does this as well. Like, he comes up with all these fantastic names. He's got his migraine academy that's called Migra Neverland.
Oh my goodness, that is a good one.
Yeah, I love it. These smart people come up with all kinds of fantastic names. So that's amazing. So describe the diet. Like, what does it look like? I've seen some, what I think of, like, I would not eat that. Like, I wouldn't even eat one of those industrial feedlot steaks, let alone a diet consisting of them. You know, I see that meat on a polystyrene tray with the cling film wrapped over the top of it from, I don't know where, I don't even know the names of these supermarkets in the United States, but I'm not eating that. Like, I would rather go back to your plant-based diet than eat that, you know, like a really good quality plant-based diet than eat feedlot meat. But I guess I've more than introduced my biases now, so I should ask you what a day.
Well, my initial days were actually like that. We were on a low budget. We went to the regular grocery store.
That's the thing, is it's going to be so expensive.
Yeah, but so I'll say two things about that. One is that the people that I know, including myself, who were able to get such extraordinary benefits, weren't eating any special kind of meat. And maybe one of the reasons for that is all of the pollutants that are I'm hesitating because this is going to sound backwards, because we know that the further you go up the chain, the more pollutants can concentrate. But on the other hand, there are certain kinds of toxins that actually animals are well developed evolutionarily to filter out. And so if you have problems with plants, or if there are toxins in plants and you process it through a ruminant animal, suddenly they've dealt with all those and excreted them. Well, just observationally, the fact is that I don't know anyone who needed the extra step of getting well-sourced meat in order to get benefits from excluding plants. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say that it couldn't be a complete step up from there. So what do I eat? I eat mainly beef. Actually, I eat beef and pork, but I still eat a variety. I like to call it my well-balanced diet. I eat from all of the food groups.
It's a steak in each hand. It's well-balanced.
No, but I mean, I eat ruminants, I eat poultry, I eat eggs, I eat fish, I eat shellfish. I do eat organs. So that's me. So if you look out into this newly exploded carnivore world, most of the things that you're going to see are going to be people eating just factory farmed
bacon.
Steak and bacon. It's steak and bacon diet. And it's absolutely amazing the results that you can get just doing that. But then the carnivore world runs the spectrum of this kind of all you can eat. I wouldn't say it's lean meat. They would still advocate for a kind of fattier cut because there's only so much percent protein that you can do well on. I don't know. No matter what I say, there's going to be someone who's going to say the opposite. But I'm just making some sweeping generalizations here. On the other end of the spectrum, there's a clinic in Hungary, the Paleo Medicina Clinic, or ICMNI as it's now called. They treat patients with chronic disease with a plant-free diet. And the way that they're treating patients, their diet, which they call a Paleolithic ketogenic diet, it's very high fat, lower protein, and they include organs mandatorily. It's not an option. And they also, it has to be deeply ketogenic. So, you know, we were talking earlier about how high protein levels can eventually subdue ketosis. And I would say that even if you're eating very high protein, most of the people that I know who bother to measure it in the carnivore community are still at least in mild ketosis.
Right. I mean, that's the question. Does it matter? Does the blood level of ketones even matter?
Once you get into the therapeutic zone, does 1 millimole, is that worse than 5 millimoles?
Right.
Like where do you draw the line? Finney has recently said that he thinks he had a graphic benefits.
Artist. I'm so sick of seeing that, like, artist rendition. I hired a graphic designer and this is what he came up with. And it was never based in any empirical evidence whatsoever, was it?
Oh, you're talking about the optimum ketone levels.
That perfectly, like, two standard, like the bell curve, like it's a normal distribution curve. And then it's being color coded by a graphic, like somebody did that in, you know, Microsoft Paint or something. You know, it's like, there's no way that the data could have looked like that.
There's no, the amusing thing about that graph is the y-axis doesn't have anything on it.
That's what I mean. That's how you know that a graphic designer made this for a book.
Right. But in his defense, he's coming from those numbers is here's the numbers that we see correlated with benefits.
Right.
And so he used to peg it beginning at about 0.5 millimolar. And the last time I saw him speak, he said, we now think that even as low as 0.4. So regardless, people who are eating only meat, sometimes their ketones are going to be down at that 0.5 level, like just barely considered ketogenic. But others are going to be higher. And anecdotally, many people have been reporting that the amount of protein they can eat on a carnivore diet for a given level of ketosis is higher than on a low-carb diet. One speculation that I have about why that is just that for every gram of carbohydrate that you eat, even if you're eating only 20 grams, that's, you know, gluconeogenesis that isn't happening. So if you're eating no carbohydrate whatsoever, you still need to make glucose.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you knew that you were at 1 millimole of ketosis when you're eating 20 grams of carbohydrate and suddenly you drop those carbohydrates to zero, you could potentially eat 40 grams more of protein and be at the same level of ketosis. And 40 grams of protein is really quite substantial because we're talking about, you know, minimum levels that might be somewhere around the 70 grams per day level. So in someone who's small enough, you could be nearly doubling your amount of protein allowance for the same amount of ketosis.
Is a simple explanation not that now you're restricting calories, right? So you've got this really restrictive diet, probably another state doesn't seem that appealing. There must be some. And so we see this every time. We talked about this weekend, that you put people on AIP and their calories just plummet. They're just not eating as much food. And I think that's pretty common. Every time you eat an elimination diet, you know, hyperpalatability goes down, right? There's this kind of like the choice thing goes away and the palate fatigue, you might call it. And so you're not going to eat as much food. And then sure, you can eat more protein just because you've also got a calorie deficit. And so anytime you impose a calorie deficit, it's going to be more ketogenic, right?
Well, that could be happening. But one thing that's funny about the carnivore community is that some of the groups encourage eating enormous amounts of food. It wouldn't be uncommon for, I mean, I'm not even trying to overeat the way that some of these groups advocate for. And I easily eat somewhere between 1.5 and 2 pounds of meat a day.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's hard for me to like gauge. What does that look like on you? I mean, you probably don't even know what it looks like.
If you think about a large ribeye steak, that's probably...
Oh, yeah.
That's probably a pound or more.
Yeah, they had 48-ounce steaks in that place last night, didn't
they?
Well,
those were extraordinary. Yeah, yeah. So that might be a whole day's worth of food for a carnivore. But then there are people like Sean Baker, for example. He says he eats 4 or 5 pounds a day.
Wow.
So that's where we're talking about the difference between the paleo medicina style eating, where it really is quite restricted, that it's going to be maybe 400 to 600 grams of meat and extra fat on top of that. But then that's the limit, whereas the, I don't know, for lack of a better word, American carnivores are saying, eat as much as you can and don't succumb to a low appetite. And the reason I think that that historically has happened in those groups is that the diet has been a bit of a draw for people who are prone to abuse of calorie restriction.
Mm.
And so people come because they say, I'm hungry and I can't keep calorie restricting. I have heard that if you eat only meat, you don't need to calorie restrict anymore. But as soon as you get into this situation, like you said, where there's a lot of satiation ability of this diet, partly because of the mono food thing, partly because it's protein and fat, which are very satiating, you get people who say, well, my primary goal is to get to as low a body fat as I can. And so I'm going to use this diet in conjunction with eating as little as possible.
Mm.
And that very often doesn't lead to the happy results that they're looking for. And so part of the culture along with carnivore that isn't exactly dietary has been, you're here to feed your body and heal and forget about the weight loss for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a real encouragement to make sure that you're not under eating.
Mm-hmm. I've always admired, do you know Andrew Scarborough?
I do.
Yeah, I've always admired his diet. I don't know how I've ended up seeing a lot of pictures of his food, but like he's eating stuff, even though I'm pretty sure it's a carnivorous diet, right? He's not eating any plants.
Yeah. So there's a bit of a history between him and Zuko, actually, because there was a time when I first encountered him, he had brain cancer. And he was on a ketogenic diet for brain cancer, and he felt like crap all the time. And Zuko was saying, because Zuko had a history of knowing someone who had brain cancer who was cured by the carnivore diet, a really extraordinary story, he was very sensitive to this and said, Andrew, you really should try cutting out all the carbs. And there was a Twitter exchange, and Andrew was saying, I don't see why that would make any difference. It doesn't make any sense. I'm just having a little bit of these fibrous things. And he tried it. And he was one of those people. He was the first time that I heard this thing that I said, where you can get the same level of ketosis for more protein. Andrew suddenly, now Andrew had very strict ketosis requirements because he was trying to hit a therapeutic target. So there was no way he was going to do anything that would compromise that. But he found he could eat more protein and still hit that target. And then suddenly he wasn't tired anymore. And what I surmise is that many people who are on a ketogenic diet, in order to keep it ketogenic, you have to keep the protein so low that you're actually not getting enough protein. Mm. But if you can do something that allows you to eat more protein, suddenly you're getting all your needs met. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I started first.
Interesting.
Learning
so sequences. Now, what I was going to say is I'd just seen pictures of his food and he was eating things that I'd never even heard of, even though he was staying within this domain that most people would consider to be highly restrictive. Like, how many people do you know that are eating sweetbreads and oysters and all this?
But not to mention mealworms and insects, any number of things.
Crazy.
It's just very cool.
It's really inspiring. And I think one of the special things about him was he had this feedback loop in health. It's the thing that's missing, right? You don't find out whether it's, I mean, actually yours is another good one, the bipolar. You find out pretty quickly that what you're doing is working.
Right.
Weight loss could be one, but that can be, you know, highly non-monotonic, right? It's all over the place.
It is.
And his was, I believe that he had auras, like as soon as his ketone levels started to drop, he'd start getting auras that were related to
the... A blessing and a curse, right?
Blessing and a curse. Like, oh shit, I'm doing it wrong. Better do something. Like, oh, that would be amazing. Like, maybe we all need that in order to make better decisions. And that's what it is. It's that feedback loop. But it sounds like that your diet is similar then, in that you're eating nose to tail. There's a wide variety of different animal foods. It's not just all ribeye steak.
Yeah, I don't go out of my way, and I'm not doing it necessarily for the principle of it, but yeah. I love food and I've always liked liver. And so I eat what I like.
That's great. That's great. Good for you. Yeah. Well, blimey, we didn't even get into your talk and I feel like it's getting dark where we're outside in Scottsdale and I feel like I should take Amber to go and buy her a steak, but we didn't even talk about her talk. Well, maybe it was, so it's going to be on YouTube. I've got the video, so I'll link to that in the show notes, but perhaps we could give people a synopsis of what you talked about at the Physicians for Ancestral Health Winter Retreat.
Sure. And the thing about that talk is you're not going to release it until after the carnivore conference, because I'm going to give a bigger and better presentation of
okay.
the same thing.
Well, maybe we won't talk about what you talked about at the Physicians
but
for Ancestral
Health. But I'll tell you what it was about for your listeners. One of the things that people think about when they hear about a carnivorous diet is, well, that's very unbalanced. How can you possibly be getting all of your nutritional needs met? And one of the surprising things to me about it is that even people who've been on it for a very long time aren't getting the deficiencies that you might expect. So, well, one of the reasons for that is really easy to discover, and that's that meat is highly nutritious, especially if you're going to include something like liver. So you can, you know, vegetables get all this media around right. how nutritious they are. But I'm kind of cynical these days. And I think, well, if I were trying to promote vegetables, since they have very few redeeming features, what can I say that they do have? Well, they do have vitamins and minerals. So now plants are known for their vitamins and minerals, but that doesn't mean that meat doesn't have them. It's just that we never talk about them because meat has this other thing that those plants don't have, and that's that it has lots of high-quality protein. And so when people think about a meat diet, they think, oh, you're just eating protein. But that's not really the case at all.
Right.
So that's one reason. But it turns out that, you know, I don't have numbers for this, and during my talk, I really only brought up questions more than specific answers. But what I did dive into was the fact that if you look at the specific cases of a variety of nutrients, you find out that a low-carb diet or a plant-free diet or both can have pretty dramatic implications for nutrition, actually in a subtractive way. So you could be eating a plant that actually makes you require more of certain nutrients, or eating a high-carb diet may require you to eat more of certain nutrients. And so I went into an exploration of that.
Mm-hmm. An obvious example is, we've talked about before on the podcast, is phytates and iron, for example, or tannins that's in.
Yes. So one of Georgia Ead's talks that I was really intrigued by had a slide showing the blood levels of zinc after you eat oysters, which goes up very high to some significant level. And you've got a graph showing this line of it going way up. And then they show the same line, but if you ate it with a corn tortilla, and it's almost back at the floor.
Oh, really? That's amazing.
It's really dramatic.
Yeah. What do we know? It goes back to that kind of like, what the hell do we know? You know, you think you know how much zinc is in this. You think you know how many calories are in that. Guess what? It, like, what do you eat it with? Like, how it's processed, how it's cooked, that
everything
makes all the difference.
Change, yeah.
Yeah, goodness. Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, you're doing some amazing work. And I think of you, I talked about how Stephanie Welsh was one of the unsung heroes of the ancestral health movement. And I think of you as somewhat the same. It's not like you have, you know, 100,000 people following you on Instagram and like 7 New York Times bestselling books, but still you're synthesizing some extremely important ideas that need to get out there into the world. And probably the best, well, of course you do have a very good online presence, but I feel like the best way to get to know more of your work is to attend one of these conferences.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you.
So ketotic.org is the first website that we talked about, and that was something you co-authored with Zuku. So this is like a more formal, less of your personal experience. And then your more personal experience website is empiri.ca. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
So are those the best places to connect with you online? Are you active on Twitter or anywhere else?
I am. I'm way too active on Twitter. I need to quit that habit.
You know, you'll probably go back into the major depressive.
My handle there is Keto Carnivore.
Okay.
And I also have started writing a book, and it's online. And
oh, wow.
The address for that is facultativecarnivore.com.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic.
My story's there.
Yeah, so you don't have to remember these things. We do a fantastic job on the show notes. And by we, I mean Elaine does a fantastic job on the show notes. So if you poke around inside of your podcast app, there's usually an info button. And you'll find in there everything that's been mentioned in this podcast, including a link to the conference you mentioned, Amber's book that she's working on. Everything else is all going to be there. Any scientific
C-cash.
References. Yeah, Zcash, exactly. Get your Zcash online. Send me some Zcash. I won't be sad if you send me some Zcash. Well, Amber, thank you so much for your time. I very much appreciate you.
Thank you very much.